Good morning. This is Patricia Colbert for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And today I have a special guest with us to talk about the pandemic in India. It was only a few months ago that Prime Minister Narendra Modi was boasting on the world stage about how India had defeated the coronavirus, suffering relatively few cases of the disease compared to most other countries. India also has the single largest vaccine manufacturing facility in the world and was churning out COVID vaccine and shipping it off to poor countries around the globe, deploying vaccine diplomacy. But this moment of political triumph for the right-wing populist leader vanished over a matter of weeks as India experienced an unprecedented surge of COVID cases. Today, what we read out of India is absolutely horrific. The healthcare system is on the verge of collapse, and oxygen supplies in many places have run out, leaving patients to die gasping for air. Bodies of victims are washing up on the banks of the Ganges River. In cities and towns, the skies are full of smoke from the cremation of so many deceased. To talk about the significance of the situation in India, I have with me today Dr. Swati Birla, a physician and feminist people's health activist who has been engaged in anti-caste and anti-racist labor politics in India and in the US. Currently, she's completing her doctoral degree in sociology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Dr. Swati Birla, welcome to the Old Mole and to KBOO.
Thank you so much, Patricia, for having me here.
Today, the outbreak, which had been concentrated in larger urban areas like Mumbai and Delhi, is rapidly moving into rural areas, which are even less well-equipped to deal with the catastrophe. The official daily average number of new cases is hovering just under about 400,000. And about 250,000 people have died. But these numbers are widely understood to be a vast undercount of the actual number of cases. Swati, I'd like to start by talking about what's behind the undercount.
So, Patricia, there are a couple of reasons for the undercounting, and there are different ways in which the whole optics and the politics of it is playing out. One of the reasons for the undercounting has been complete denial on the part of the Modi administration. We had an administration that was completely underprepared for doing, you know, the contact tracing, as well as the counting of the people who are admitted into the hospitals and people who are actually dying away at home. Second, you have a system which actually has always undercounted. So in India, most people escape being counted as being born or dying. And that is especially true of people who are at the margins of the system. So the poorer people in the rural areas often do not get registered for birth or for death. So they enter the world and they exit the world very quietly. That quietness has actually become even more sort of prominent now, because what you're seeing is the dissonant sort of optics of it, people dying, burning in the graveyard. Your streets are now, all of them have been converted into graveyards. There is a consistent reporting from the central government that, one, not many people are tested, not many of them are COVID positive, and the last is not so many people are dying. Now, the pushback against the undercounting has come from various quarters, and you really see the way in which the state and the bureaucracy sort of works together in very horrific ways to create a certain kind of silence around death, and that creates a sort of a dissonance, but also a despairing anger. When citizens are taking the efforts to actually count death or to seek out for help, there has been a very consistent sort of repression of the people, either by calling on the Epidemic Act or different national security acts are being called in order to sort of repress people from reporting and from talking about the disease.
You mentioned an Epidemic Act. Is that legislation that was passed?
No, so this is an old act that is being reactivated in the current moment, talking about the illness or talking about death has now become like an act against the security of the nation state.
How does all of this work in Modi's interest? Why is there so much repression of information going on?
I think the undercounting sort of plays out in multiple different ways in the interest of the current state. One, only 2 days ago, the Asia Human Rights Watch basically came out and talked about why the state is more interested in the image it has in the eyes of the international community than it has in actually counting or providing care for its people. There is a certain investment also coming from certain classes of people, both in the diaspora and in India, who are reluctant to see or reluctant to name the failure of the state as being part of the problem. There is a very strong sort of pushback against the undercounting. That pushback is coming from citizens who are talking about the multiple failures of the state. One of them being the fact that during this period, there were a couple of things that happened that have actually resulted in the current surge. One is the elections which have taken place both at the local and the state level, the open rallies, you know, the election rallies that have taken place, which have caused the surge to take place. The third is the fact that the state has basically encouraged, because of its own electoral interest and consolidating its constituencies in some places, to have festivities. There were, you know, a lot of, for example, Brahmins who were walking around in very close contact with each other to celebrate Hanuman Jayanti, which is the festival for the monkey god. And you also have very large sort of festivities, which is like the Kumbh Mela, where you have hundreds and thousands of people accumulated in the river, near the river Ganges, to celebrate a festival which usually takes place every 12 years. But this time it was sort of brought forward by a year. And so that is a very steady constituency of Modi government. Many of these people actually do a lot of work during the electoral times to get votes out. So you have the electoral sort of electoral calculus or a calculation in mind, getting that vote and assuring your fate for the next 4 years, given all of the fiasco that is happening, was a very urgent situation for the Modi government.
So they were taking risks with the public health in promoting these electoral activities because they needed those electoral wins. What we read mostly in the Western press is that the outbreak was because the country had become too complacent, that the social measures that are needed to prevent the spread of the disease have been widely and prematurely abandoned. But you have a different take on what set the stage for this catastrophe.
I do not mean to say that the undercounting also has not taken place because of a complacency of the state. What the state did was that it silenced all of the scientific voices and citizens' voices as well, and created a certain sense of complacency in order for the elections and in order for business as usual. On April 30th, we had 300,000 cases, and the Ministry of Health is still putting out these weird videos asking people not to wear masks, not for social distancing, not for home care, but to drink tea with cinnamon and basil. Or we have been watching really disturbing videos, basically in police stations, people being washed with cow urine. So there has been sort of a steady disinformation.
The other kind of factors had to do with this neoliberal project of Modi to dismantle, yes, a lot of the structures, the public health, the health services. Tell us a little bit about that.
One is, in the long term, what we have seen since 2014 is a systematic sort of gutting of the public health infrastructure. We already had a public health infrastructure which was doddering, but in the middle of the pandemic last year, the Indian state passed a budget for healthcare and for COVID provisions, which was only 0.34% of the GDP, which falls much short of what was required. Now, this is on top of a public health infrastructure, which is both completely sort of absent in many ways in the rural system as well as in urban care system. Almost 85% of the people in India do not have access to a consistent and a good quality government healthcare system or even a good private healthcare system. Hospital care being overwhelmed and not being able to deal with non-critical cases, and therefore these patients should be taken care of by their loved ones at home, is something that is coming from this argument that, you know, the healthcare system is overwhelmed. But the question is, why was the healthcare system overwhelmed? Why were alternative arrangements not made available? It would illustrate better if I told you about what the citizens were doing. Is that, for example, in the Muslim communities or in the Sikh communities, they have converted religious spaces, which are large spaces, to create a certain kind of either an oxygen langar, which is basically a community provision of oxygen, or community kitchens, or community healthcare system facilities. Masjids have been converted into doing that. So the way in which people are using existing sort of social structures and refashioning them in order to provide healthcare, which can be done in a more communal fashion, and therefore decreasing the burden to provide that kind of care. What the state could have done is made it a more centralized, systematic centralization practice, opened up schools, maybe opened up universities, which are now running as if they were normal. They could have sort of used many of these structures and repurposed them in order to provide care at that level. So there are many ways in which the state could have, in the short and the midterm, avoided the crisis, but it hasn't. It has chosen to systematically pursue, even in the middle of a pandemic, a more neoliberal or a capitalist agenda, which undercuts the system, which makes it impossible for it to respond.
This is probably a good place to talk about the vaccine program, because that was the shining star of Modi's administration. And the vaccination program in India is kind of dead in the water. So what happened there?
So there were two things within this whole business of the vaccine distribution. One was the fact that you had sort of created a near monopoly situation by making Serum Institute of India the sort of the main contractor. You also had a government institute like Hafkin that should have been sort of given more money than it was given in order to scale up the production. There is a lot made about the Indian vaccine diplomacy, and I really want to push back against that, because, you know, India did not gift away any of the vaccines. And that is not what creates a crisis for the people. India and the Serum Institute basically went on a path which would actually make sure that it maximized profits for them, at the cost of basically each vaccine is available between 1,200 rupees to 2,400 rupees. What this means is you're asking someone who is incapable of earning that kind of money in a single month to pay about $4 to $8 per vaccine dose. So what the vaccine crisis in India is, both a problem of not scaling up production by creating more number of manufacturers, but also not acquiring those vaccines and making them freely available to people.
Narendra Modi has been trying to manipulate the image of what's going on in India throughout the crisis. But there's another way that I think the crisis has possibly worked in his interests, and that has to do with the relief organizations.
Patricia, what we're dealing with really is a mercenary party in control of a capitalist state and in collusion with, you know, the corporate interest. Mm. This is a time when the government and also a lot of small and big operators that sort of feed into the system, from hospitals to, you know, the oxygen black market, and a lot of right-wing organizations across the country and in the diaspora. So what we're seeing right now is a sort of a disaster capitalism. So you have two different flows of money. I mean, other than the corporate contracts that have come in for cannulas and oxygens and so on, you have another two different sources of money that are completely unaccounted for. One is the PMO Care Fund, which a lot of international organizations have contributed to. Now, this fund is a $1 billion fund right now. It counters what used to be the Prime Minister's Relief Fund, which had some auditing, some accountability, some transparency. We have no idea where this billion dollar is going to go. We have no idea what is happening to it. And also, one of the things is that the BJP and its family of ideological organizations are the richest fascist organizations in the world.
BJP is Narendra Modi's, for our listeners, is Narendra Modi's party, right?
Yes, sorry. Okay. So BJP is the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the ruling party right now. The treasury of that party is by far the largest treasury in that entire South Asian political sort of scenario. But now the disaster funds or the COVID funds have become another source of income for that PMO Care Fund. The second funding that has come and that is going to sort of increase the right wing or the fascist strength in India in many ways is going to flow through these what seems like benign Hindu cultural organizations in the diaspora. What these groups do is collect both individual and other contributions in the name of COVID, and they channel them through a lot of grassroots sort of fascist or fascist front organizations in order to basically consolidate their constituency on the ground. And so you have this continued connection between the diaspora and the homeland and consolidating of the constituency, which will keep basically this right-wing government in power for some time to come. And that's what a lot of the COVID pandemic money is going for. And it is kind of really frightening to us what this will mean in terms of their powers to buy elections, their powers to repress.
What do you see for the possibilities for progressive forces in India? I mean, you talked a little bit about the springing up of some mutual aid organizations. And certainly Modi is very much a Trump sort of figure. And it's very clear in this country that Trump's handling of the pandemic was a big part of his recent electoral loss.
I must say that Modi is just so much more efficient than Trump is. Like, I think
I'm sorry to hear that.
Trump's money that he collected during the pandemic doesn't come close to what Modi has been able to accumulate. So this is efficient fascism to another degree. Also, in the last 1.5 years, for example, there were about 6,000 people who were arrested for being against the national security. So various anti-terrorism laws have been used to raid people's houses and also arrest these 6,000 people. These are activists who are lawyers, human rights activists who have been arrested and are jailed. And some of them are also COVID positive. I mean, the jail situation as far as COVID is really horrendous. So what you have is a very repressive state that has made it very difficult for the left to operate. Now, in that circuit, you have a second thing which is happening is you have a lot of civil society organizations, NGOs, and also citizens' bodies that have sprung up because you need to ferry someone to the hospital. You need to ferry someone to get oxygen. You need to get community kitchens running. So these organizations have stepped up, but they have been strapped by the FRCA, which regulates foreign funding reception for a lot of the progressive organizations. Since 2014, but even before that, the Modi and Shah regime, when they were active in the Gujarat state, have followed basically a way of starving these NGOs of money, of getting any kind of external support especially. And so what you have is a state that keeps on expanding because of the amount of money it gets, and it makes it difficult for these organizations to exist because of lack of resources and because of repression. So movements are basically both thinking short-term and long-term, but they are extremely exhausted.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Swati Birla. And I also want to tell our listeners that we're going to post some links on our webpage, the Old Mole webpage on the KBOO website, to organizations that they can donate to and have some confidence that their resources won't be appropriated by right-wing or fascist forces to further support and build the Modi apparatus there. So again, thank you very much for joining me today, and I hope we get to talk again.
Thank you so much, Patricia.